Chapter 22. Just 8 months after the Clapham Rail disaster, I took a call early one Sunday morning to warn me that there had been another disaster. It was August, and Ian was on holiday and I was the forensic pathologist in charge of London and the southeast of England. At this stage, no one knew how many bodies there would be, but one thing was certain, there would be bodies. This time, catastrophe had occurred not on the railway, but on the River Thames. I waited for more news before setting off, and my first stop was the police pier in Wapping. A leisure boat had sunk somewhere near Southwark, and bodies recovered from the vessel were here. That was all I knew. An old police sergeant greeted me, and to my astonishment he was close to tears. "Almost got my 30 years in, Doc, and now there's 25 dead from the river, 24 on the boat, another one picked up this morning 8 bridges upstream at Vauxhall. Never thought I'd see anything like this. They're all kids. Kids in their 20s. So the boat that went down must have been one of those party vessels, the sort people hire to cruise up and down the Thames. I had seen them and heard them many times. Young people on the deck, clothes fluttering under the lights like giant moths, laughter and music discernible from either riverbank. Through the windows, the shadows, colours and movement of the dance floor. The sergeant added, "Doc, the police surgeon's already been in and certified them all dead." Now he really began to cry, walking away, shaking his head. I heard him blow his nose before opening the door and going back to the front desk to fend off the press. Wapping Police Pier is a Victorian police station standing right beside the river. At the back, an area had been designated the temporary mortuary. It was just a room, really. Its concrete floor was nearly covered by body bags. All of them lay open, and in each one lay the body of a young adult, all dressed for a party, many in bright colours. I looked across this devastating scene, and I noticed something strange. Their clothing had been disturbed. Dresses were displaced. Trousers opened. I immediately went back out to the sergeant. He grimaced. Police surgeon opened all the clothes, think he might have been checking what sex they were. I wasn't pleased, but there wasn't much I could do about it now. Probably they had been overwhelmed by events and had needed to feel that he was doing something, anything useful. Check pulses, listen for heartbeats. I'd seen this sort of reaction before. Even highly trained professionals want to do something when they know full well that the correct thing to do is absolutely nothing. I then went to Westminster. I knew the deceased wouldn't stay long in the temporary police mortuary. I wanted to ensure that Westminster Mortuary was prepared for the large number of bodies that was about to hit them. Oh no, I remembered that the usual manager, Peter Bevan, was on holiday. His deputy was in charge, and I had never found this man to be anywhere near as organised or efficient as his boss. Peter's calm, capable, organisational skills were exactly what we needed when managing a mass disaster. However, at least the staff were busy preparing for the huge intake, and all the post-mortem tables and necessary equipment were ready. The sight of these preparations gave me, for the first time, a sense of dread that was something close to nausea. It was fleeting, but powerful. With another pathologist under my supervision, I agreed to return the next day when the bodies had been brought over from Wapping to start the examinations. Gradually the facts emerged. On that calm summer night, a huge dredger had collided on the Thames near Southwark Bridge with a small pleasure boat called the Marchioness. The Bow Bell had dumped its cargo of gravel at Nine Elms and was proceeding back out to sea to dredge for more. The Marchioness had been hired to celebrate a birthday, and an international crowd of young people was partying on board. Initially, the Bow Bell hit the little Marchioness at the back on the starboard side. This caused the pleasure boat to rock and keel over. A witness said the Bow Bell then mounted it, pushing it underwater like a toy boat. In fact, the anchor of the dredger cut right through the pleasure boat's upper deck before a second impact pushed the back of the Marchioness round to starboard, causing her to roll over. Here are some survivor statements. I felt a jolt, then I noticed the stern moving out in a starboard direction. I saw water come through the open window. I felt the boat keel over. I remember turning around to head towards the windows to escape as water started coming in. I knew the boat was going to go down. Within a matter of seconds, The lights went out. Everything was in darkness. I was then thrown forward by a wall of water. The whole boat filled instantly. When I surfaced, I was some distance away from the Marchioness, which was partly submerged. I felt the right-hand side of the boat dip down suddenly. As the boat tipped over, water came flooding in through those open windows on the right-hand side. Everybody who had been on the dance floor lost their footing, and with me and chairs and everything movable went sliding down to the right, down into the water which was filling the dance area incredibly fast. I went underwater. Suddenly the boat tilted onto its side and the toilet began to fill with water. I tried to unlock the door and get out. When I managed to get the door open, the boat was completely submerged. I felt the boat rock. Then it all of a sudden sort of swerved round and I lost my balance. I think I fell against a table. I saw this hull coming through the boat. I saw this anchor coming in. Glass started breaking. All the windows smashed and showered with glass. Water started pouring in. A terrifying ordeal for the young people on board. All passengers' chances of escape were hampered by the great speed of the sudden rotation, loose furniture, darkness, the cold, turbid water, and for some, the lack of accessible emergency exits. The result was that, to get away, physical exertion and strength were required, which compromised the survival chances of many. A much later statement on the disaster made by Dr. Howard Oakley, an expert on survival and thermal medicine, said, "Sudden capsize is known to be a shocking experience, to which individual reactions would have varied from panic to calm determination to escape and survive. Physiological responses to that shock are likely to have shortened the time for which victims could hold their breath, which would in turn have reduced the chances of successful escape." Within 30 seconds of impact, the Marchioness was lying at the bottom of the Thames. 14 vessels helped to rescue the living, but not for several hours, at least, were the dead retrieved. Many of the dead were probably trapped on the boat. Others must have been thrown overboard. The Thames is a treacherous river, deep and dark, with a rich mixture of currents and tides, which are known to hide bodies for days and even weeks before giving them up. In fact, it was 5 hours before the first body from the Marchioness was found in the river, and almost 2 weeks until the Thames yielded the last one. A drowned body, or a body which is immersed in water after dying some other way, will first develop opaque, wrinkly skin. Anyone who has spent too long in the bath will have an idea what this looks like. It's often called washerwoman's hands. The thick keratin layers on the fingers, the palms, and the soles become macerated, and the skin appears very white and wrinkled, whatever the ethnicity of the deceased. After a few days, if the body remains in the water, this macerated skin will begin to separate and it will eventually peel off. I should also say, because it is relevant to what happened next, that the time it takes a body to float to the surface depends on the gas in the bloated and decomposing body. Generally, the obese surface fastest. The Marchioness went down shortly before 2 a.m. on the morning of Sunday, the 20th of August. By the end of that day, although I had, with a colleague from Guy's, viewed and organised the bodies, we still had no idea how many people on board had died. There were clearly a lot of survivors, so we were harbouring hopes that there might be few further bodies. By law, the coroner is in charge of those bodies, and Westminster's coroner, Paul Natman, came back to London from his holiday in Devon and met with me and senior police officers to agree how we would process the dead. As coroner, he had to establish positive identification of the bodies, and we discussed how he wanted to do this. In mass disaster management, false identification is the biggest fear. This is obviously hideous for everyone, especially if a family later begins to suspect they may have buried the wrong body. The coroner rightly wanted the most secure and accurate identification methods that were possible. Now, we have the option of DNA analysis, but although the subject of much pub discussion, DNA identification was just not available to us then. The two most secure means were still fingerprints and comparison of teeth with dental records. The problem with dental records is that you, of course, have to know the name of the missing before you can begin to search for their dentist, and only when the name of the dentist is known can you request their records. And then that request can take a very long time to fulfil. This is especially true if records must come from other countries. And by now we knew that the partygoers on the Marchioness were a high-flying crowd from all over the world. That was clearly going to cause problems and delays. As a result of all this, fingerprinting was the first choice of identifier. Fingerprinting plus dental records would be ideal. Absolute accuracy can be a time-consuming business, but the coroner took the view that accuracy was more important than speed, which is surely correct, although I can understand this is very frustrating for anxious relatives. Those who are trying to cope with the possibility of sudden bereavement after a mass disaster often cannot understand why the relatives are not simply invited into the mortuary to walk through the lines of fatalities to claim their loved one. Many relatives of the Marchioness victims, believing that identification must be easy, did in fact suggest that if they could just be allowed into the mortuary, they could find their family member. I understand their need and their logic, but it's false, and it would have been utterly inhumane to allow this. People find it hard to believe that in mass disasters, visual identification is unreliable, especially so when death has been traumatic or the body has been immersed in water. But even the uninjured and undecomposed dead are often simply not recognisable to those who knew them as animated individuals. Without life, facial expression, movement, robbed of our essential selves, our bodies can look very different. And this is certainly the case when the dead have been held by the Thames for hours or days. The fact is that relatives, even immediate family, when they are under great stress, are very likely to make mistakes. They may identify a body that isn't their relative, or they may not correctly identify a body that really is their loved one. These are known as false positive or false negative identifications, and they happen more often than you might think. Later, perhaps much later, the identifying relatives sometimes worry they were wrong, and then change their minds. This can occur long after burial or cremation, when our ability to review the identification is lost. Add to the difficulties of identification, the immense emotional trauma of having to look at many, many bodies in the mortuary to find the one you think may be your relative. With all my experience of death and dying, I know I couldn't walk between rows of victims and reliably identify my own wife or child or parent. I should say that being called on to see a body for identification purposes is quite different from seeing that body once police and pathologists are sure that the correct identification has taken place. I personally believe every relative who wishes to do so has an absolute right to see the body of their deceased. It's cruel to deny, for whatever reason, a family this chance to say goodbye personally. But the reality is that bodies may be injured, decomposed and smelly. We can do a lot with reconstruction, but we can't perform miracles. So it may take many hours of talking and discussing, of initially showing photographs of the body, before we can move into the room where the body lies. And there may be more time again before the relatives will actually look at the body. Spending this time with families is crucial. So is care and compassion. We must do nothing to add to the trauma. As unreliable as visual identification is the use of mobile or movable indicators, such as clothing, jewellery or wallets. These may be treated only as clues to identity because people swap jewellery or look after friends' wallets. And to use clothing, we would have needed to know exactly what the victims were wearing on the night of their death, relying on descriptions from others, when such descriptions are seldom either accurate or available. Despite this, the coroner was inclined to accept visual identification and mobile indicators, but only from those bodies recovered from the wreck of the Marchioness itself, and only as long as they showed no decomposition. In all other cases, the coroner instructed that mobile means of identification were not dependable. The coroner's conclusion, when we discussed identification, was that fingerprinting of each body was essential. As a list of the suspected missing was compiled, police were dispatched to homes, unless they happened already to have fingerprints on their database, to collect personal items on which fingerprints might be found, so that these could be used to match those taken in the mortuary. Our problem was that these were drowned bodies. They were likely to be damaged, either by aquatic predators, or by contact with rocks, bridges, boats, or other underwater obstructions. Drowned bodies show all the discoloration and bloating of normal decomposition, plus some much earlier skin changes. Even if retrieved from the water within a few hours, those inevitable washerwoman hands can make fingerprinting difficult. And when there is a complete loss of skin from the hands, elegantly called degloving, well, then it can be extremely difficult or almost impossible to take fingerprints from the deeper layers of skin, the dermis. At first, this disaster seemed easier than Clapham because there was no severe mutilation of the bodies. As time went on, however, bodies arrived in worse and worse condition, and decomposition became our nemesis. Once again, each body travelled through a system. First, we described in detail clothes, jewellery and general appearance. I then helped remove the clothes and performed an external examination, describing tattoos, scars and anything unusual that might assist identification. Police officers made notes, and the body was photographed and refrigerated. The second phase was the full post-mortem, after which the internal organs would, as usual, be replaced in the body cavity and the body sewn up and made presentable for viewing by relatives. Finally, I submitted a report about each of the deceased for the coroner, concluding with the cause of death, drowning. If he was satisfied with all this, especially the identification processes, he would open an inquest and release the body. The first free-floating body was found in the Thames before 7 a.m. that Sunday morning. No more were found that day, but in the afternoon the Marchioness was raised, and when I reached Wapping Police Station, 24 had been found on board and arrived at Wapping in the warmth of an August day. They were tagged before being carried on to Westminster Mortuary. This mortuary is run by Westminster City Council. At that time, it had 6 holding fridges, refrigeration for 60 bodies, and a further 6 units for extra-wide bodies. It had freezing facilities for 18 bodies. Whatever the outside temperature, bodies are refrigerated to a temperature of 4 degrees centigrade. This slows down the decomposition process but does not stop it completely. We do not freeze bodies until the post-mortem has been fully completed. During a disaster, we work in a world of constantly changing information, often helping to revise and then re-revise it. The key problem for those managing the Marchioness victims was that no one had any idea exactly how many people had been on board the boat, nor who they were. So within a couple of hours, while the rescue operation was still going on, and before the first body had been found near Vauxhall Bridge, a telephone bureau had been opened to process information from friends and relatives that might help us identify victims. And by that afternoon, as Westminster Mortuary prepared for its influx of dead, relatives of some on board had started to appear at police stations with photos of their loved ones and descriptions of what they might have been wearing. By the end of that first day, the police believed that there had been 150 people on the Marchioness, of whom 65, including those 24 bodies taken from the wreckage, were considered missing. The next day I was back at the mortuary starting the long process of identification and post-mortem. We learned that 87 survivors had identified themselves, and we had 25 bodies. So we knew that if police estimates of the number of people on board were correct, there were a lot more bodies to come. Expecting so many further arrivals, we worked as speedily as accuracy would allow. It was an extremely intense week. To see so many young people here was not just unusual, it was shocking. I was aware, as though in my peripheral vision, of the intense misery of parents fearing the worst, waiting for news. Bodies were laid out one at a time on the 6 tables in the post-mortem room, and we worked our way doggedly from one to the next, feeling the greatest service we could perform for the bereaved was to do our job as efficiently as possible. By 8 o'clock that evening, we had completed post-mortems on all 25 in the mortuary, and of these, 13 had now been fully identified. The next day, Tuesday the 22nd of August, we learned that the Casualty Bureau had received 4,725 calls from anxious relatives and had already amassed more than 2,000 documents on individuals believed to be on board. As we waited, a few more bodies were found in various places on the Thames, upstream and downstream of the disaster, and the police revised their estimate of the number of people on board the Marchioness down to 136. By the end of the day, there were 30 bodies in the mortuary and police thought there were 27 more to be found. But by now, immersion time in the Thames was taking its toll. Waterlogged skin was falling off fingers, and the officers were having trouble getting prints using the standard inking process. The coroner called for dental records to help confirm the identity of the remaining fatalities, but this would take time, and relatives were anxious for news. So attempts to fingerprint continued, but as the hours went by, conventional fingerprinting was failing. It was now necessary to use a specialist technique and more sophisticated equipment. This equipment was based in a laboratory in Southwark, which had no facilities to manage bodies. The routine process for individual bodies recovered from the Thames that could not be fingerprinted at the mortuary was to remove the hands, fingerprint them at the lab in Southwark, and then return the hands to the body. They were sewn back on to avoid distressing relatives who, when the body is appropriately arranged, were unlikely even to see the stitches. The coroner allowed this, and so the procedure was followed. 17 pairs of hands were removed. That evening, more bodies were found between Westminster and London Bridge, and then another, far downstream past Wapping. The next day, 8 more bodies were found. One, retrieved at Cherry Garden Pier on the south side of the river at Bermondsey, was wearing uniform and strongly suspected to be the Marchioness's captain, Stephen Faldo. Another was nearby, then 4 more were found near HMS Belfast, not far from London Bridge. 2 more were on the other side of the wreckage, upstream around Westminster. That gave us a total of 44 bodies. By now we had positively identified 24 of these. Of course, there was an assumption that every single body found on the river must be from the Marchioness, but this was unlikely to be the case. There are suicides and other deaths in the Thames almost weekly, and we had to be aware of this. By the following day, there were 48 bodies, and although we had been working as hard as we could, 6 were still waiting for postmortems. The police were saying they now believe there had been 140 people on board the Marchioness, 84 survivors and 56 lost or missing. The dental records of all the known victims had been requested, those from abroad via the relevant embassies. That night, Wednesday, the Casualty Bureau closed, saying it had gathered all the information about the missing it could. However, bodies were still being found, and the police revised their estimates again. They thought there were 83 survivors and 56 lost or missing. But there was now a report, for the first time, of a 54-year-old woman running the disco on the boat. This was followed by another report of a woman jumping into the Thames near HMS Belfast after a handbag full of bricks was found on the riverbank. As we carried out our postmortems, some officers began to grumble at the way the Casualty Bureau had closed when so many inquiries were still outstanding. And by Thursday evening, there was a new development that pushed police estimates of the number of people on board up again. A group of gatecrashers at the party came forward to say they had survived the sinking, but a friend was missing. Meanwhile, back at the mortuary, a request was sent to the lab for the return of the 17 pairs of hands as soon as possible, so that they could be reunited with their owners. Another 8 pairs of hands were delivered to the lab. There was not much more we could do now but wait. It was the Friday before the August bank holiday. Outside the mortuary, people were leaving hot London for the weekend. We were waiting for dental records to arrive, fingerprint information from the labs, or just more bodies. 50 had now been recovered. After all that frantic activity, the mortuary seemed almost eerily quiet. No new bodies arrived in the mortuary over the long weekend. On the Wednesday, the police attempted to name the people still missing. One of them was the party's host, Antonio Vasconcelos, who had been celebrating his 26th birthday. Another was a Frenchman. And there was still one unidentified body in the mortuary, a man in his 20s. He may have been nothing to do with the Marchioness, or he could be the gatecrasher, who had still not been named. By the end of the week, 46 of the 50 bodies in the mortuary had been positively identified, and the others partially identified, meaning that we still needed more information to make it positive. except for this one anonymous young man. Who was he? Nobody had any idea. He fitted no description. Since he was carrying a distinctive key fob, the police photographed it and decided to release the picture to the press. So we had one person completely unidentified and still two missing people, the Frenchman and Antonio Vasconcelos. We could stop worrying about the gate crasher, though. He had shown up alive and well. On Friday, there was a major step forward in the identification of the mystery man. The distinctive key fob was taken to the Frenchman's flat and it opened the door there. Now only the party host was missing. That night, the body of a young man was found downstream of the wreck, between London Bridge and Bermondsey, somewhere in that area broadly known as the Thames Upper Pool. We were fairly confident this was Antonio Vasconcelos, but after 2 weeks in the water, we knew it would take some time to identify him positively. We were also confident that the other bodies in the mortuary had nothing to do with the Marchioness, and the police were sure now that there were no more dead. The toll was 51, and there had been 137 people on board. We had worked hard, and I felt had served the victims and their families well. Only afterwards did I understand that, while I had been immersed in my work at the mortuary, a lot more was happening inside and outside it than I realised. Everyone responds rapidly and wholeheartedly to an emergency. Everyone does their best at the time. So although everyone, no matter how well-meaning, should be held to account, it is hard to receive criticism afterwards for actions that may have been taken under extreme pressure in a crisis. The emergency and follow-up services, after many of the 1980s disasters I listed earlier, frequently found themselves on the receiving end of some very angry criticism. It is such anger that very often fuels reform. This is nowhere more true than after the sinking of the Marchioness. I learnt that although some relatives early on identified their dead at a special viewing room at the mortuary, many others were told, due to late recovery of the body and the extent of the decomposition, they could not, they were not allowed to, see their loved ones. Sad reunions of the living and the dead do not usually take place at the mortuary. More often the body is moved to the undertakers first. But undertakers, as well as the police, later claimed they had been told such viewings should be strongly discouraged, and even, in the face of opposition, relatives should be refused access to the dead. I do not know who ordered this or why. When I learned of it, I assumed it was the result of misplaced compassion, because someone thought that seeing a son or daughter in a state of decomposition is traumatic. However, that person clearly did not know that not seeing them is even worse. One relative later wrote, "We were never actually prohibited from seeing our daughter, but were talked out of doing so at every stage. When I went to the undertakers expecting to see her, the coffin was already sealed. I could not sit in a room with a box, and so walked out of the funeral parlour. I feel very strongly that I should have had the opportunity of time alone with her." Her mother has since seen photographs of our daughter, and from the photographs, there really is no reason why we should not have seen her. Another wrote, "On Friday the 25th of August, I was told by the coroner's officer that my son was not recognisable as a human being. On Thursday the 31st of August, the undertaker phoned me to say they had collected his body. I went immediately to their premises and asked for the coffin to be opened. I wanted to make sure that I had found my son. The undertaker told me that he had been given orders not to let me view my son's body. This made me extremely upset. I was never given the opportunity to see him, to touch him, and to say goodbye to him. The undertaker told me that he had been an undertaker for 25 years, and he had never before been told that relatives could not view a body. I was told the coffin was sealed and it must be kept sealed, he said. Since it is the undertakers who place a body in its coffin, and they are the ones to close it, this was clearly untrue. I still worry whether it is in fact my son who we buried. I think the root of this concern is that I was never allowed to see him. There is an additional concern that the bodies may have got mixed up. Later, I looked at photos of his body. They were far less horrific than I had expected. I could not help feeling ill at ease with how things had been arranged. My concerns about whether I was ever given his body have meant that I have, in the past, sought an exhumation order. I had no idea why the relatives of the Marchioness victims had been denied access to their loved ones. This seemed a cruel and unnecessary decision. It was to be a few more years before further information emerged to offer us, the relatives and those of us who had worked on the case, a possible reason why bodies were not seen and coffins not opened.